They may have had different notions about it, but thanks to Ken Albella, we now know that people who lived during the Renaissance were concerned about proper diet, much as we are today. Albella is our guest this week, and he will be interviewed by Drew Burgesson, professor of history at the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
During the Renaissance, books on proper diet were all the rage. According to food historian Ken Albella, we all know that many of us are intensely diet and health conscious. It would probably come as a surprise, though, to learn that 500 years ago, literate Europeans were equally obsessed with eating right. Then, as now, a veritable industry of experts churned out diet books for an eager and concerned public. This plethora of diet books are the subject of Ken's first book, titled Eating Right in the Renaissance, and published in 2002 by the University of California Press. Hi, Ken, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
These authors have very different notions about what constituted a healthy body and a healthy diet. Can you describe them for our listeners?
Sure. Well, a healthy diet is a very different thing in the Renaissance than it is in the 20th century or 21st century. For the most part, they were not very interested in avoiding fat or eating less red meat and that sort of thing. And in fact, body size was not really a concern of theirs much at all, as long as someone was of an average size. But what they were really more concerned about was the qualities of the food as categorized by humoral physiology, which means that foods would be categorized as either hot or cold, dry or moist, and depending on a person's own individual constitution, they were recommended foods that would counteract it to sort of keep their humors in balance.
Could you give us an example?
Sure. Well, if you had a melancholic person who had cold and dry humors, and obviously that's sort of psychology built into that, is that they would be prone to melancholy, it would be good for them to eat warm and moistening things, things that are bright, for example, like saffron or white wine, or things that would counteract their natural tendency to melancholy.
So this is very different from our concept of nutrition today, which presumes that all human beings require the same kinds of nutrition on a daily basis.
Absolutely. Well, every single person's diet would have to be tailor-made for their own specific constitution and also for their lifestyle. Most people who got a lot of work could eat heavier and more crass foods and things that would take a very powerful digestion to break down. But there are recommendations for people who are sedentary or didn't get a lot of exercise that they should eat lighter foods, things like chicken and veal or kid, and things that wouldn't be so heavy on the digestion. And there's all sorts of other factors that were taken into account, really in a very holistic kind of medicine that we would not consider today. For example, the environment that a person lived in, how much sexual activity they got, the amount of sleep they received, the regularity of their bowel movements, things that are we don't really take into account because we assume that everything that goes into your mouth gets equally digested and you get all the nutritional value from it in a quantitative sense, where in the Renaissance they're really more concerned with qualitative sense. And there's an assumption that if food goes bad in your stomach, if it corrupts, you get no nutritional value. So there's very, very careful attention paid to the consistency of the food and the corruptibility, for example, something like peaches. Because they so easily go bad outside of your body, there's a danger that they'll corrupt also inside you.
These authors also gave advice about many other things, like how to season your food, how to cook it, how to chew it, and even the order that you ate your meal. Why were these nutritionists so concerned with what we would consider to be cuisine?
Well, cuisine really comes under the aegis of dietary medicine in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. There's an inherent logic to this, such that if a food naturally has too much of a particular quality, for example, if it's too cold, if you have something like cucumbers that are cold, adding a condiment to them, or something that just means a food you add to another food, would make it hotter. For example, if you added spices to something that's cold, you could make it a more balanced dish, or something that was too watery, by roasting it, you could naturally correct that food. Or if something was too hot, you could temper it with things that were cold, like, for example, vinegar was considered cold and dry. It's good to put on foods that are too hot, like, let's say, pigeon, some bird like that. So, yeah, there's a culinary logic built into dietary medicine that really lasts, well, right up until the invention of haute cuisine in the 17th century.
So could you give us an example of a well-balanced meal for, let's say, a Renaissance scholar at an Italian university as compared to a peasant?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's very big differences. A scholar would have to pay special attention to the digestibility of the food. Only very light things, and generally only two meals a day. That's another thing, is that they ate their big meal around 11 or sometimes 12, and that would be dinner, and their smaller meal, supper, would come around 4 or 5. The assumption is now there's a big argument over this. You know, some physicians think that the bigger meal should come at night because you're sleeping at night and there's more time to digest your food, and the sort of ambient heat withdraws internally, which you can sort of sense. You know, when you're sleeping, the heat withdraws inward, and some figure that was better for digestion. Others thought the morning meal should be bigger, but in any case, a scholar would probably eat very simply seasoned foods, would never mix too many foods, different types of foods, in one meal. No fish and meat or vegetables and fish, things that wouldn't necessarily go together. And there'd be a strict order from things that were easier to digest to things that were harder, because there was this terrible fear that if they ate something that was hard to digest and then something lighter, the lighter food would corrupt on top of the stomach before being digested. And then there's all sorts of other tricks that they would have. For example, eating cheese at the end of the meal was assumed to be a stopper that kind of kept in they don't call them gastric juices, but they basically kept in the heat and kept in the food while the stomach seethed, because their idea of digestion is really one of cooking rather than of breaking down food with acids. Now, that would be, let's say, a scholar's meal. Okay, you have a light bird, one glass and a half glasses of wine, maybe a few olives, some bread. Naturally, it has to be an accompaniment. And sugar would go on the food, you know, rather than showing up in dessert. That's fairly typical for medieval and Renaissance cuisine. Now, the peasant obviously has no rules. He eats whatever he can get his hands on. Much of his diet will consist of bread, and especially, well, by the 16th century, an increasingly large proportion of the household income would have to be spent on just basic staples. So we're talking beans and bread, and during Lent, maybe stockfish, and obviously many more vegetables. You know, wealthy people could afford meat, usually fresh, and spices and things like that. Poor people had to rely on more preserved foods, you know, cheeses and sausages and bread.
You know, in your book, you say that you suggest that attitudes about food and nutrition were also changing, particularly in the mid-16th century. Can you describe some of those changes?
Well, I think the major shift has a lot to do with the recovery of ancient Greek authors like Galen and Hippocrates, reading them in the original Greek and translating them. And I think that the major change has to do with the fact that earlier authors, the medieval authors, depended for the most part on Arabic authorities like Avicenna and Averroes and Rhazes, authors like that. What came with the shift is that, and it has a lot to do with many other factors, but I think that's maybe the most important of them, is the shift occurs that in most medieval authors, there's an assumption that what tastes good is very good for you, hence the proliferation of sugar on all their food. And there's this idea that your stomach sort of grabs the food better and concocts it better, and it will do you better service than a food you don't like and eat anyway that's supposed to be good for you. Now, what changes in the course of the 16th century is really that there's an assumption increasingly that all bodies need some kind of correction, in that the food that's best for you is something that doesn't necessarily taste good, but it's what physicians tell you is best to counter your own humoral imbalance. And there's an assumption that everyone is imbalanced, and something that will be ideally suited for your what we would call lifestyle. So the medical literature is increasingly guilt-ridden after, say, the mid-16th century, and that lasts all the way through, well, you could argue up until the invention, up until the 19th century, when, you know, vitamins and understanding of chemical digestion comes in and things like that. But it's
really interesting because it's very similar to our contemporary language of wellness and sickness. It's almost like we've shifted back to an interest in maintaining balance as opposed to correcting imbalance.
Well, that's true. I mean, medicine at least is making an attempt to be more holistic nowadays, and that's something that we've certainly lost since the early modern period.
There's another element in the change in your book. You described a shift in the audience for these dietary manuals.
I think increasingly they are written for a popular audience. Now, some countries always have popular health manuals. England is the example there. And some countries will continue to make large professional tomes written in Latin for physicians who are being asked to give advice for their patients. But increasingly, through the 16th century, and this just has a lot to do with the availability of print and the cheapness of paper and things like that, and increasing literacy that comes with the Reformation, but increasingly these books are written for popular consumption, such that I think it's fair to say that with over 100 titles that come out in the 200-year period covered by my book, it's fair to say that they were pretty obsessed with their diet, certainly as much as we are. Some of these were bestsellers. So clearly, ordinary people got very interested in dieting, not necessarily to lose weight, not necessarily... they didn't necessarily follow the advice that was in there, and I think that's maybe true of diet books today.
That certainly is true.
but we're fascinated with the idea that we can improve ourselves somehow by means of something so simple as changing our diet.
Another interesting element in your story was that the dietary authors start to criticize their princely audience, or what was initially a princely audience, and maybe the gluttony of their food habits.
Sure. Well, I would argue that that's probably a reflection of a divergence of several different stratifications of society that occurs in the 16th century. Now, clearly, in the Middle Ages, there were different types of people. There were, you know, monks and professional bureaucrats and lawyers and people who were connected with court. And there is a good range of society there. But I think for the most part, anyone with money aspired to the courtly culture. In the course of the Middle Ages, anyone without money obviously ate whatever they could get their hands on. What changes in the 16th century, which I think I've tried to prove, is that there's carved out a niche that is, on the one hand, uncourtly, that doesn't aspire to eat, you know, the lavish feasts and excessive spices and sugar and jumbled number of courses, and that's basically defined as gluttony by these dietary physicians, but they also want to separate themselves from lower peasant ways. So I think that carving out a unique, let's call it a food ideology if you want, is a whole way of thinking about eating that's connected with their intellectual interests and their philosophical, sometimes their religious interests also.
And then in the mid-17th century, this fad for dietary how-to books declines. Does that mean that people actually became less interested in nutrition?
I don't know whether I would still argue that. In fact, I've written that book, which was several years ago, actually. It took a few years to get in print. But I've been working on late 17th and early 18th century medical writings, mostly about fat is what I'm writing about right now, a delightful topic. And I'm finding that there actually are a lot more nutritional theorists out there than I suspected. They're not popular. There's only a handful, maybe, of popular texts. There's not a big spate of them like there are in the 16th and 17th century. But there are a handful in the latter 17th century. I think for the most part, physicians were more interested in treating diseases that could make them money. So there's nutritional theorists tend to focus more on scurvy and gout. Right. And obesity and things like that,
right?
Because there's a market for it. There's more people with money there, and they obviously want to cater to that market. So there are less dietary books, but I don't think it disappears. In fact, I've found evidence of humoral theory way into the late 18th century, where I really didn't expect to find it. After there are, for example, mechanical theories of digestion and chemical theories, and you know, by the 18th century, there's animists and vitalists and all these very interesting schools, but humoralism is still there, very interestingly.
Great. Well, thank you very much. My guest today has been Ken Albala, Associate Professor of History at the University of the Pacific and author of Eating Right in the Renaissance, published in 2002 by the University of North Carolina Press. If you are interested in reading more about the history of cuisine and nutrition, consider Ken Albala's next book, forthcoming from Greenwood Press in 2003, Food in Early Modern Europe, 1500 to 1800.